Trouble is, you're seeing it at its worst time, really.
It's because it's winter.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty grim, isn't it, really?
I don't know, it's not that bad, I think. Sometimes it's quite foggy, but
some days are right, but it's very overcast. You know, we get a lot of cloudy days, and especially today is it's it gets a bit grey and dull. Should be off skiing somewhere in Switzerland, you know, where the sun's shining.
Mountaineering.
Yeah, mountaineering, that's right. I've done a bit of that over the years.
Is that how you got involved with the expedition?
Why I joined the Antarctic Survey was I knew the survey existed, but my parents went to, because I lived in Cambridge at the time, my parents went to an open day at Cambridge headquarters, and they looked, you know, had a good look around the exhibits, and then they asked the one of the personnel managers, I think, there, and if they could forward an application form to me, and you know, I was interested in that, and I filled out the application form, not particularly thinking that I was would have the right qualifications for the job anyway. And about a month later I got an interview, went through the, you know, the basic procedures, medicals, etc., and I had a couple of interviews, a trade test, because I was, you know, going in as an engineer, so they, you know, you have to be able to do the job, you know. So they give you a written examination, and then they give you a trade test. About 3 weeks later, I got a telegram and telling me I'd got the job. So I was a bit shocked, actually. you know, because it's quite something to go down there, I think, and to be chosen to go down there. It's I think it's quite a privilege, actually. But then I started work with them in about, I think it was June, July 1979. And I worked at the headquarters there for about 3 months. You receive your equipment, you go over that, you go on various climbing expeditions up in Derbyshire and the Lake District. This is all to do with training. and they have various conferences where you get to meet all the other base members, you know, who you're going to be with for the next sort of 2 or 3 years. So it's all very exciting, very interesting. You learn a lot. And then I joined the ship down here at Southampton. I think it was the 19th of November. It sailed for, we sailed for North America for a start, because we went over to Jacksonville in Florida, because on the way down the ship pays various sort of goodwill visits. So it started off in Jacksonville, Florida, then to Rio de Janeiro to take on supplies and bunker. And then we went down to Argentina, and then from Argentina to Falkland Islands. And then we started our various base reliefs in places like Faraday Island, Sydney Island, South Shetland Islands, South Georgia. And then eventually about 7 months later, you actually get to your base where you're actually going to go. So it's quite a trip. It's sort of, 15,000 miles. It's the other side of the world, so it's quite a voyage, really. But, you know, it's great fun on the ship, as you can imagine. There's about 60 other people travelling with you, apart from the crew. This is just the base members, because the survey operates five bases in the Antarctic. So there's a lot of personnel going down there for the summer, just for the summer. And, you know, the long-term people like myself who are going down there for 2 years. So, you know, visiting these various places on the way down, it's quite an experience. Great fun. Anyway, eventually you get to your base. And it is quite a shock, because it's... you're a bit sort of out of things for quite a while, because it's something that you're not used to. You're not used to the conditions. Particularly on my job, I'm getting used to working in the cold and things that happen in the cold, vehicles break down, etc. Takes you quite a long time to come to grips with the situation that you've been put in. I would say it must have been possibly even a year before you really come to terms with it, and then you begin to understand what to do at a certain time, what not to do at a certain time. And by the end of the 2 years, you've gained a great deal of experience about, you know, how things operate down there. And with all the other base members who you work with, because you all work with a team, even though you are individuals and you're skilled in your own right, you also need other people to give you a hand now and then. And
can you give me an example of what kind of things you had to come to terms with?
It's coming to terms with, it's particularly on my field, with things like diesel engines and petrol engines that are operating at sort of minus 30, minus 40 degrees. You get a lot of problems with fuel, fuel pollution, ice getting into the fuel, and actually just electrical problems, because, you know, at that temperature, electrical components don't work properly at all. So you've always got to be on top of this sort of thing. You know, you remove certain parts, because if you don't remove those sort of parts, you know they'll freeze up solid. And when you come to start the vehicle next time, if you haven't removed them, that's going to be a big job to get it to go again. So what I always remember, one of the particular snow cats, I always used to remove the carburetor. I used to remove the carburetor and keep it in the base, because I knew that if I wanted to start it up in an emergency, it would be quicker to fit a nice clean carburetor onto that vehicle. It would maybe take me 20 minutes or so. I knew the vehicle would start, rather than spending maybe 2 or 3 hours removing that, cleaning it, getting it in good working order again, putting it back on. And then hopefully it'll start. So things that may take you a while at the start, you do save time in the long run. There's just various things like that. Batteries have to be removed. You can't leave a battery on a vehicle at those sort of temperatures. It'll just disintegrate. So every time you want to start a vehicle, you've got to take a new topped up battery out there. It's the little things, just the little things that are the most important. What else can I say? Of course, starting a vehicle out there is quite a task in itself, because at those temperatures, even though we use special lubricants, if you take the sump plug out at sort of minus 40 or so, you remove the sump plug and no oil will come out, because the oil is completely set solid. Now, there's no way that a starter will turn that engine over to get that engine to start. So what we have is a large Andrews, which is a large Andrews heater, which is a blow heater. And this burns aviation fuel because all our vehicles run on aviation fuel because diesel solidifies. So it's no use to us at all. So we have to use basically kerosene. And this heater burns kerosene as well. And we have the two pipes going underneath to the sump. And we set this heater going for about maybe 2 to 3 hours. And it'll heat the oil up enough so you can, the starter, when you turn the key, the starter will turn the engine over. And hopefully, if all the fuel system's clean, the engine will start. So to start a vehicle down there, you know, it's not just sort of jump in the cab, turn the key, away you go. It can be 2-3 hours before you get the vehicle going. Not so bad in the summertime when the temperature's sort of -5 or so. You can possibly start the vehicle quite easily then. But of course that's only sort of, that's quite a luxury. You only get that sort of maybe 2 months of the year. The rest of the year you have to go through this procedure. So it can be quite a task. And of course all our vehicles are kept outside. There's no way we can sort of take them, keep them in the base, because the base is 80 feet under the ground. We do have a garage down in the base, but we can only get sort of one vehicle down there at a time, and it's quite a task to get it down there anyway. So if something major does go wrong with the vehicle, we do try to get the vehicle down there. But otherwise, all the work's got to be done on the surface, you know, and that can be very uncomfortable indeed. You know, you're working with big heavy gloves on all the time. If you take your gloves off, you know, you can do the odd nut or bolt up. But you know, your hands start to stick to the metal and you just tear your fingers to pieces after a while. And your hands get very cold. So you sort of off with the gloves, do one bolt up, back on with the gloves, let your hand warm up a bit and then do another one. So everything down there takes time and everything down there is so much more difficult.
How do you start an engine when you are on a field trip?
On a field trip, if we go on a field trip, we take one of the bigger vehicles with us, apart from the Skidoos. Even the Alpine Skidoos can give you a lot of trouble. When I was down there, I made a point of always carrying a spare carburettor, because that's one of the biggest problem now is carburettors. Because they just ice over. You get ice between the plates. So we always used to carry a clean carburettor in a tin kept underneath a seat. So if you had a problem with the carburettor, you know, you knew you had a problem straight away. The engine would stop or it'd start to misfire. It's only two bolts. Quickly change the carburettor and the two cables. Put a new carburetor on, away it goes. Then in the evening, when you're inside your tent, you can, you know, you've got plenty of time in the evening, it's nice and warm. Strip the carburetor down. We always used to send a repair kit with the carburetor. Rebuild the carburetor, and you're ready for the, you know, if you have a problem the next day. Before any of the people go out on a field trip, I teach them how to do this. So, you know, during the winter months when there's no field trips going on to prepare for the summer season ahead, we show them how to strip carburetors, change the plugs, etc. So when they're out in the field, you know, they can do these jobs, which obviously you have to be able to do. The bigger vehicles, we have to take, if we want to take one of those out in the field, we have to take an Andrews heater with us. We have to take large amounts of fuel to run the heater and the vehicle. And we also have to take a generator with us because we need to produce electrical power to run the Andrews heater. So you've already got a sledge full of fuel, heater and generator. So again, it's quite involved. So if you're out in the middle of the field, you start your generator up to drive the Andrews heater to blow hot air onto the sump to get that vehicle going. And if everything's right, not a problem. But you couldn't it would be very dangerous to go out on a long field trip without taking any of this equipment with you, because the temperatures can drop from being a nice beautiful day, minus 10 or so, it can drop to minus 40 within a few hours. It's a very unforgiving environment unless you're prepared for it, you know. If you prepare well, there's not a problem. But if you don't prepare well, then you're going to run into trouble.
You call it the real Antarctic.
Yeah, it is the real Antarctic, yes. Yes. I think Halley Bay is I think it's the farthest south base that the British government operate. And it's the only base that is operated in a situation where it, you know, it's on a floating ice shelf. The actual base is 80 feet under the ice. It's on a floating ice shelf. And the nearest civilization is possibly South America, which is about 2,500 miles away. So you're there, you are with 18 other people, and you're completely cut off from the rest of the world. And the ship can only get there possibly 2 months out of the year. And that's only if the ice would allow the ship to get in there to relieve the base. So it's the real Antarctic, yes.
You said that after a time on a field trip, you started to get sort of neglective towards dangerous situations.
Yes, you do. I think when you're 20, 21, 22, like most. The age there, I suppose I was 21, 20, I think I was 22 there. Most people are aged between that age and, say, 30, I think the oldest person. You're young, you're enthusiastic, your danger is, you don't really register danger in so after a while, and you become very oblivious to the dangers. You know they're there. You live with it all the time, and I think because you live with it all the time, even on base, there's dangers. There's just as much danger on the base as there is being, say, 100 miles away from the base on a field trip. Because if you have a large blow, and you can easily get lost in the base perimeter, as I mentioned before, when you have a what's called a whiteout. Or a blow, when it may blow, say, constant 60 knots for 2 weeks solid, but we still have to do things outside. Fuel's got to be fetched in. If you get lost in that base perimeter, you may be only 100 yards from the shaft entrance, which lets you into the base, but you might never be able to find it because you just lose all sense of direction. And it's the same out in the field. If you have a blow, we stop immediately and put up tent and wait till that blow is gone. Then we're being very careful because we know the dangers there. But the other times when you're in, say, crevasses, or you're crossing a pressure ridge, or scaling a small sort of mountain cliff or ice cliff. The dangers are there, but you tend to ignore the danger, I suppose. You put it at the back of your mind, and because you always want to find out that what's over the other side of that hill or whatever. So I suppose you get used to it, and you become very oblivious to it, really. It's a difficult thing to explain, really, because I think you're used to living with danger anyway, because you're on a base floating in the South Atlantic on an iceberg, basically. That's what you're doing, and you're living with that all the time, so any other extra bit of danger doesn't really register too much, because you're already in a basically precarious situation. I mean, if you said to somebody, oh, okay, I want you to live for 2 years on a floating ice shelf down in the Weddell Sea in the Antarctic, 2,500 miles from civilization, with temperatures at minus 60 and winds up to 150 knots, I mean, most people would just tell you to, you know, don't be ridiculous. So I think because you already accepted that, so you the rest of it is, you know, you're oblivious to it, really. You get used to it. Simple as that. I think you get used to it. But you get used to being careful, you know, when you've got your mountaineering equipment on whenever you're out in the field. So you are pretty prepared for it. We train for this during the winter. We do a lot of rope work. We've got all our safety equipment, you know, up to speed, all in good shape. All your food, etc., all your fuel supplies. We put all this together during the winter months. So when we do go out in the field in the summertime, whatever we can do, we've already done, because it's too late when you're in the field. If you've forgotten something, or something's broken, it's if you can't repair it, then you have to forget about it and do your best, really. So we prepare as much as we can, but you are working in quite dangerous areas, so there has been incidents over the years. People have got in trouble. Some people have got in some serious trouble. But it's not something that sort of bothers you too much. We all train for rescue, doing various rescues, pulling people out of holes, etc. But again, it's something that you accept. The year that I had on, my first year, we lost a base member. Unfortunately, another one was seriously injured. It was unfortunate, and it was at the very beginning of my 2 years down there. I'd only been there about a month and a half. I won't go into the accident because it was such an unusual situation. But it happened, and we all had to come to terms with that very quickly. And the worst aspect about it was our base commander. And I'd got to know him quite well, because I'd met him at Cambridge several months earlier. And, you know, you're working with these people all the time very closely. And one minute he's there, next minute he's not. And it was a terrible situation. But it's a situation you have to come to terms with. And we continued that year as best we could. And we were short-handed on the base for a start, which made life very difficult. But you come out of it. You recover from it. We at the end of the year, it was a successful year. At the end of the year, as far as the work, etc., was concerned, and the base morale improved over the months, over the winter months. But we all took that risk, you know, you all accept that risk. You're all doing something you enjoy doing, so, you know, so what? Because you can be run down in the street, can't you? Just the same as you can be, you know, get into trouble down there. So we all take risks in our everyday lives. We ride on trains, we fly on planes, we drive cars, we play sports even. And everything carries risk. So I don't look at it in that respect, really. But
what's there next?
We did have a funeral. It was, and the person in question was, because of the situation we were in, the ship had already left. And as I say, I think it was about a month or seven weeks or so. So the ship was well on its way back and would have been very difficult, even probably too dangerous to come back again. We had the parents were requested to, we buried the particular person at sea. That was the way they wanted it dealt with. A difficult sort of thing to undertake, but it was carried out, yes. The other person who was seriously injured had a very damaged his neck. But because we have a doctor on base and a full surgery, he was made quite a quick recovery. I think he's still got a bit of a limp, but I haven't seen him for many years, so I don't really know, but I think he made a bit of a quick recovery. But, it was a difficult situation. But, and I still think about it. You always do, I think. Because I think it was somebody, once you get to know them, and you get used to them, and then all of a sudden they're not there. It's quite a shock. What else?
How did you get along? There were 60 persons on the base.
On the normal base, there is 18 people. That is the usual personnel on the base. That's a mixture of scientific staff, support staff like myself, which is made up obviously of chef, engineers, electricians, a doctor. There's always a doctor on each base. And then you have your various scientific disciplines. So there's usually 18 people on this particular base. It varies from base to base. But we all get on reasonably well, because you're living in close quarters. Obviously, there's time to time when you get very uptight with people. There was often a scuffle, or let's just say a scuffle, a disagreement, because whenever you're with a group of people, you're going to disagree and everybody's got their own point of view. So, and the worst time, of course, was at the weekends. We always used to work Saturdays, and Sunday was a rest day. And that was always the problem, was the weekend, because then people had more time to sit about. When you're during the week, you've got your own job to get on with. So you don't really have a great deal of contact with the base members apart from, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Saturday and Sunday was always... could be a problem. You know, we always used to have a good drink, you know, in the evening, and there was never any trouble. The 2 years I spent there, there was only one scuffle, and that was a very minor affair. There's a few arguments, but then whenever you put people close together like that, you're going to have difficulties, because personalities clash, don't they? And some people got like to have their own way. Simple as that. But as I say, the 2 years I spent down there, I can only remember every one sort of thing that could have got out of hand, and that was sort of dealt with pretty quickly. But other than that, no, surprisingly not, actually. I thought that would be a problem. But no, it wasn't at all, which was quite surprising, really.
What kind of contacts did you have with the outside world?
When I was down there, this was before, today I believe they have satellite communications, where they've, you know, you've just got to pick up a telephone and they've got a satellite dish down, they can speak to anywhere in the world. When 1979, when I was down there, the only communication was by radio to either they used to speak to other bases like the South African base or the German base, which is not far away, or one of our other bases, which is in Rovere Station or Faraday. But our main communication was with Port Stanley, Falkland Islands. And I think it's three times a day, the radio operator was in communication with the radio at Port Stanley, because they receive all our technical information on the weather. It all goes out in code. So three times a day they would be in communication. If they could make voice communication, it was passed by voice. If they couldn't do that, it was went out on the teleprinter. And if the communications were really poor, it went out on Morse, because it's all on code. But obviously they used to like to do it either on voice or on the teleprinter, but because that just made my life a lot easier. But other than that, pretty limited, actually, because the only people you can speak to really are other bases on the Antarctic. We used to sort of have a regular communication with people. But apart from, I don't think really they had any contact with anybody in South America as such. Maybe possibly in an emergency there would have been people you could have called upon, but we would have had to, if there had been a problem, you'd have just had to pass it on to another base, and obviously down the chain it would have eventually got to somebody to give us a hand. But so communication is very limited, actually. If the weather was bad, sometimes you couldn't make any communication. It just depended, really, on the conditions. But they had a very extensive communications radio room down there, the latest technology at the time. And I say now, I think they have satellite telephones, so all they do now is just pick up a telephone and call Cambridge HQ.
Did you get any news?
Yes, I used to. You were allowed 200 words a month, either way. So I could send 200 words to my parents.
Usually, and then how much washing you had.
That's right. So you're allowed this allotment. Sort of, they were allowed 200 in, and you were allowed 200 out, and that was every month. And that used to go out on the teleprinter through Port Stanley, and then they would send that on to Cambridge. So that was something interesting. You always look forward to getting your 200 words, because you didn't have any mail, of course. You can't receive any mail. The only time you used to get mail was if there was a plane coming in the summer. Before the ship, they may carry some mail for you. Other than that, it was just the ship, and all the mail used to come on, the whole year's mail used to come on the ship. So when the ship came in, you had quite a bit of mail to catch up with. But it didn't really bother you too much, honestly. You enjoyed the sort of bits of information you got, I think. And of course, there's no television, no radio. So all you do is that you have music. And we used to receive the BBC World Service quite a lot. When the conditions are good enough, we can pick that up quite well, actually. So, you know, we used to listen to that. So you could pick up on the news, what was happening in the world. But it didn't bother you too much, really. You know, you were down there and you weren't really interested in it. It seemed light years away. Oh dear. What else?
How did you feel about a continent which is constantly demolishing your instruments, your vehicles?
Yes. What you did, you had a job to do, and it was to keep everything going, because at the end of the day, the most important thing is to, you're a support staff to support the scientific staff who are down there. That is your job, that is your function. You kept things going the best you could, and that is your job. At the end of the 2 years, you leave the base. You've done your job, so that's all that matters, really. The vehicles were, every sort of 6 or 7 years, a vehicle was taken away anyway. They were either scrapped if they were no good, or they may have been brought back later, overhauled. But your function is to keep things going, to support the scientific studies that were going on down there. What sort of condition the vehicles are in is irrelevant, really, because as long as you've done your job and got things going to the best of your ability, and everything functioned properly, that is your job done. You don't get any extra marks for sort of having a nice shiny vehicle as long as the vehicle worked, you know, and did its job. Because that's all you're down there for, is to, the main reason for the base being there is for scientific study. And as you're on the support staff, your job is to do all your best to make life a little bit easier for everybody else. That's it, really.
What makes you go back there?
I've got no carving to do, so I need to take one bit.
What makes me go back there? It's been a long time since I've been there. I left there in 1983 after, well, I did my 2 year contract, and then I worked at Cambridge headquarters for about 6 months, and then I went back there again for the summer season to rebuild the base. It's 1983 since I was there last. And it's always on my mind, quite honestly. I've always thought about it. Because you always look at the good times, you never look at the bad times. And you always remember the good times. I don't know, it's just a fascination with the place. I would hope to think that I will go down there again one day. Now I've had time to think about it. I've had time to take it all in. I think I would enjoy a visit there. Maybe if it's only for a summer, or maybe it would be a winter again, I don't know. But I enjoyed the solitude of the place. I enjoyed there's a certain beauty about the place as well. It's unpolluted. You feel alive there. It's a very difficult thing to describe. The air is so clear. It's cold, yes, but on a sunny day it can be invigorating. It's like a frosty morning when you get the very hard frost and the very sunny day. It makes you feel invigorated. It's just an interesting place. What else can I say? It is the most unusual place I've ever been to. And I always said when I left there, I'd like to go back there one day. Hopefully that will happen. I hope so.
What did you like best about the place?
What did I like best about the place? That's a difficult question. I think there's several. I think you could answer that in several ways. I think I enjoyed working with some very interesting people. The characters that were down there with me, the other base members, they were fascinating, some of them, to be with. We all had a great time. We all got on very well indeed. I learned a great deal. I learned a lot about my job and a great deal about other people's jobs, and some of the jobs, such as meteorology and talking to the various people down there, the scientists, was fascinating. And I perhaps would never have learned this if I hadn't gone down there, quite honestly. So it's a difficult one, again, to answer, really. What else can I say?
Okay.
I'm running out of ideas here. Oh, is this any good?
Hmm?
Is this any use to you? Is it? As I was saying, it's a difficult place to describe, because, as I say, I've shown various pictures and I've shown film, my cine film, to people, and a lot of people have never heard of the Antarctic, never heard of the Falkland Islands before the Falkland Islands War. So, and for people, you say to people you've lived on a base for 2 years with 18 other people, about 2,500 miles from the nearest civilization, and people just can't take that in.
Is it difficult to describe the scale?
It is very difficult to describe the scale of the place as well. It's a huge place. It's sort of it's a lost continent. There's a whole continent down there, locked. Well, it used to be many millions of years ago, connected to South America and South Africa, and it's split away over the many millions of years. It used to be a tropical landscape, because obviously it must have been for coal to be down there. There's vast amounts of coal and minerals. So it's a continent, huge continent, locked in ice. I mean, there's, in some places the ice is up to a depth of sort of 6 miles deep. So there's obviously, the place is absolutely enormous. And you feel such a speck there, such a small person in all this enormity. And in the winter, of course, the continent literally doubles in size, because the sea freezes over, and the continent, all the sea around the continent freezes over, and the continent is sort of twice the size as it was before. So if you could imagine, 98% of the world's fresh water, if you take all the lakes and all the rivers and all the streams in the rest of the world, 98% of the world's fresh water, that would include, and those streams include the Arctic as well, because that's fresh water. Some of that would be fresh water. 98% of the world's fresh water is in Antarctica, because ice is water, and that is fresh water. So that gives you some idea of the scale of the place. And again, it's difficult to explain the size of it to anybody. And it's difficult to explain the environment to anybody. To mention you worked in minus 50 degrees centigrade, and stripped down vehicles in that sort of temperature out on the outside, you know, most people would find that very difficult to believe, but that's what you have to do. You know, you're out in the field. I can remember once being out in the field on a field trip. We started off at quite a reasonable temperature. It was about minus 10 or so. And that evening it dropped down to minus 40. And I can always remember just shivering all night long, because it was so cold. Even though we had the thermos on, full blast, it was still cold. And it's just those little things that the idea of being in the tent at minus 40 degrees is a difficult thing for people to accept. But, yes, it is a difficult thing, very difficult thing to describe. Unless you've been there. this is why you'd like to go to these reunions, the Bass Club, etc., because, you know, you meet people, pals you've worked with, or they've worked on other bases, and you can have a good old chat, and you go over the old times and things you did, and it all comes flooding back again, you know, the memories. And it's very interesting. That's why I keep in touch, you know, touch with all these people.